All right, you guys.
Welcome to the show. Hey, man, how are you doing? Hey, chat room guys. Good to see you.
There's a chat room. These guys, they hang out there during the show. They talk to me. They talk to each other. And they have a great time. And it's great. Join up the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. It's true that I'm not really an org as much as I am a human man. But the thing of it is, though, somebody else owns .com. So I'm .org. So, yeah. Anyway, there you go. Yeah, dude. So did you guys see the new Star Wars thing? That's what I want to talk about. Oh, I guess I'll tell you. Will Potter's going to be on the show and Jim Loeb's going to be on the show. And they're going to both say interesting things. So if you hang around and listen to them, you'll enjoy the interesting things they say. ScottHorton.org/chat. Okay. Now, so here's the thing, man. Did you see the new Star Wars trailer? It's really cool. I like it. Well, so the thing is, I mean, if you're approximately my age, then there's a pretty good chance that you were a Star Wars kid too. But me more so than everyone. Boy, was I a Star Wars kid from age 3. I saw Empire Strikes Back when I was 3. And then, thank you. And then I stayed that way till I was about 11. And then once I turned 11, then no, now I don't play with toys. Now I'm a big kid, you know. But up until then, from 3 to 11, boy, I was the most Star Wars-y Star Wars kid you done ever done met, man. I'll tell you. And, yeah, I love it that much. I actually even still like the prequels, even though I completely agree with every word of the red-letter media criticisms of them. It's still true history about how the Clone War happened and everything, so what are you going to do? You know? I just try to watch around Binks. Just ignore that part. I even like the politics part. Well, I am politics boy, kind of, ain't I? Anyway. So, yeah, I can't help but like the new one no matter what. Even if it sucked, I would like it. But I think I like it. I have to admit, the lead, it ain't that he's black. I don't care if they get a black guy to be the Jedi or not. You know, in Star Wars, the different races are defined by, you know, being from completely different planets and civilizations and sharing no common family tree whatsoever. So there is no black and white in Star Wars. They're all just the humans, just as evil as each other, just as good or bad as each other in every way in Star Wars. So, it's the persecution of the alien races that are the basis for Imperial fascism in Star Wars. No coincidence that the Emperor set up all the aliens to be the separatists. You notice that? Yeah. Anyway, not to blow the prequels for you if you never saw them. But anyway, so I don't care that the guy's black. I just think that that guy is kind of funny looking. And I'm not sure how good of an actor he is. I've never seen him in anything else. So I don't know. Maybe he'll be fine. He just seems like, he seems kind of funny looking. I don't know. Not in a black way, but just in any way. But I don't care. Whatever, dude. It's Star Wars, man. If I can tolerate Binks, then I can tolerate a couple of bad casting choices. And hey, as far as I know, they're good ones. And now the guy that plays the X-Wing pilot guy, I saw him in this other movie. Ghost in the Machine, it was called. It was pretty crappy. But he was decent in it, I guess. He seemed like a pretty good actor, so whoever this Poe Dameron character is, seems like he's probably in pretty capable hands there. I've seen that guy in one thing. The girl, never seen her in anything. The bad guy, I've never seen him in anything. I saw people complain, oh no, it's the guy from whatever movie, but I never saw that movie, so I don't know what they're talking about. So that's good. I'm coming at it kind of fresh there, you know. And I don't know if you guys saw, probably you didn't, but I read Dan Dresner this morning at the Washington Post, and he made a point that, you know, it's pretty revealing, really, when Han Solo is telling the girl and the guy that, yeah, no, the stories you heard, they're all true, man. The dark side of the Force and the Jedi, they're real. There really is such a thing as the Jedi and that kind of thing. Well, Boy, that kind of raises a lot of questions about what happened after the destruction of the Death Star and the death of both Sith Lords that ruled the galaxy back at the end of Episode 6. The whole, boy, I tell you, it sounds like, based on that, it sounds like they certainly have gone in an entirely different direction from the, you know, post-Return of the Jedi books. Grand Admiral Thrawn and all that. Everybody in the galaxy knew who Luke Skywalker was. But, you know, apparently by the time of this Episode 7, nobody's sure whether any of that's even real or not. That's kind of strange. Then again, I guess the girl, she seems like she comes from a pretty back-asswards planet way out on the Outer Rim somewhere, right? So, I don't know. Obviously, there are Ronchevist Nazi imperialists rising back to power. Is there a New Republic? I don't know if there's a New Republic. I sure hope that Princess Leia and Han Solo aren't married with kids like in the books. They could go in a different direction than that, probably, right? Or I don't know. Hope so. I don't know. And then people say, well, where's Luke Skywalker in the thing? Well, he's in it. They show him. It looks like he's at Mustafar, although maybe not. Maybe he's just out camping somewhere. But doesn't it look like he's at Mustafar and he's with R2-D2? And he puts his hand on R2-D2 and it's his, you know, machine hand. So, I don't know, man. You know, Kit in the chat room says that his wife thinks that Luke is going to be the bad guy. That's what my wife thinks, too. But I think, no. Here's why you can't do that. And I actually never read these, but there's reference to them in some of the Star Wars books that I did read, that there was a comic book series called Dark Empire where Luke turns to the dark side. And then Princess Leia brings him back again. So they got to throw out, and they have officially thrown out all of the post-Jedi writings as not canon. The whole expanded universe never happened. Like we all want to do with the prequels, right? Reboot the prequels. That's what they should have done instead of Episode 7. Start over with Episode 1. Keep Kenobi, but ditch everybody else and start again. You know? Anyway. Sorry, Tanner. But I'm thinking, nah, they can't make Luke the bad guy. He's Luke Skywalker. And he had his chance to rule the entire galaxy, to do a coup d'etat and take over the entire empire. And he said, nah, I'd rather die. Go ahead and kill me, your highness, because I'm not going to be your servant. Blam! Well, maybe that was his problem. He just wanted the number one spot. But, nah, he knew the emperor was afraid of him. He knew that he could have been the emperor himself, not just the emperor's sidekick. And he chose, go ahead and electrocute me to death if that's how you're going to do. So I just, they're not going to do that. Can't be Luke. Our wives must be wrong, Kit. There's got to be something else going on than that. They do show him, and hey, he's wearing a brown robe. And he's still pals with R2-D2 in the clip. So, now maybe he becomes a bad guy in Episode 8 or something, I don't know. But, yeah, I don't know. I liked it. I liked the way they show her salvaging in the old crash Star Destroyer, right? That was in the first teaser trailer. They show her driving up to the old crash Star Destroyer. But then in the new one, they show her kind of rappelling around in there. An old ruined docking bay inside old Star Destroyer. That's pretty cool, man. I like that. You could tell that the dust wasn't computer generated by George Lucas. It was, you know, they filmed her in a dusty place doing her scenes. Seems plausible enough. I'm pro dust. So anyway, that's all I know. I'll be first in line on like the third day, I guess, to see it in the IMAX. Don't nobody go spoiling it for me. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, y'all. So, All right, more Star Wars. So Kit says, you know, I think Mark Hamill is the voice of the bad guy. Nah, because I already read a thing where there's an old guy who's a bad guy, who I don't know the actor's name or the other guy's name. Something Vaughn somebody or other. He's an old guy, and apparently it's his voice. He's like the emperor to the new young guy's Vader, you know what I mean? And that's him saying, "How have you felt the awakening of the Force?" and whatever. But there is a voiceover of Luke. And it's Luke, it's the, and you know, here's the whole thing, Kit. Now check this out, man. See, in the second trailer, it's the same speech that Luke gave Leia on Endor. The Force is strong in my family. I have it. My sister has it. Or my father had it. Or my father has it. I have it. My sister has it, right? But then, and then he says, but you have that power too. But so the thing is, I'm trying to remember which word it is, but there's a had or a has in there that's different than Jedi. So it's basically the same line, and you're not sure whether that's just the line from Jedi being replayed over the new trailer, or whether this is him saying the same thing again or what. But there's a has or a had or something in there that's different that made me think that, yeah. And then it's interesting too, isn't it? Cause in the part where they're voicing over there, it's apparently a woman handing Luke's old blue lightsaber lost at Bespin to another woman. But then later we see the black guy, Flynn, is the guy wielding it. And it starts out with saying, "Have you felt it?" And it shows him, right? So it seems like, yeah, it's the rogue stormtrooper is the Jedi. And probably not very likely he's Luke's son, right? And I don't think the girl is anybody's, you know, Leia's daughter or anything like that either. I don't know. But they play that line from Jedi, but it's a little bit different. And then it has one more thing at the end. You have that power too. No, that's what he tells Leia too, right? Anyway, I don't know. I don't know. But, yeah, I don't think Luke's gonna be a bad guy in the new one. That's too easy, right? They gotta, you know, it was Lawrence Kasdan that wrote the screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back, helped J.J. Abrams write the screenplay for this. They fired the first writer and brought in Lawrence Kasdan. And I actually read a little thing that, talked about Kasdan and Abrams just palling around with each other for a year. And traveling all around the world doing different jobs. Abrams would be directing some other thing, but then people would see him sitting around with Kasdan, taking long walks on the beach and hanging out, you know, all day Saturday and just going over and over and over and over and throwing out bad ideas and starting over with better ones and over and over and over. 'Cause you gotta imagine the pressure on these guys to not blow it. You know what I mean? As much as the religiously Star Wars of us want to like the prequels, we have a hard time doing so, and everybody else hates them. Everyone else who's not bound to love them somehow is, yeah. And Abrams knows that, and he knows that Episode 7 cannot suck. It cannot suck. And it cannot be so obvious as Luke's the bad guy. It's gotta be better than that. That's what I think. I might be wrong, but I don't know. But I still wish I had a Millennium Falcon. I would fly it around. Although it would probably have a hole in its transom. Anyway. All right, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. The prequels of the Rand Paul of Star Wars. Yeah, exactly. That is what I'm saying. So, I don't know. Yeah, Von Sydow. He's the bad guy in it. I've never seen him in anything else, or if I do, I don't know. But he, I think, is the emperor to the other guys. Yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, Star Wars. I don't know. Yeah, the prequels, man. The prequels, they really could have been great. And I still do kind of like them, but... you know, I read a thing one time where... A guy was interviewed and confirmed the rumor that the interviewer had heard that Lucas had asked him to co-direct, basically, the prequels. And the guy had said no. Lucas had offered him $4 billion or something, right? $1 billion. I'll give you $1 billion if you come and help me with the prequels. And he said no. And then the guy interviewing him almost choked him to death. I'm not sure with the force or with his bare hands or something, but there was some kind of like, God, are you kidding me? You son of a... And what happened was, is this is the only director that Lucas ever got along with other than Spielberg, I guess. And he had helped Lucas with the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles TV series back in what, late 80s, early 90s, something like that. And Lucas really liked the guy and got along well with him. And Lucas apparently doesn't do too well with people who don't completely toe his line. See Gary Kurtz, for example, right? So, you know, once you're a billionaire, it's pretty hard to tolerate people not kissing your ass anymore kind of thing. Anyway, but he liked this guy enough. He said, man, you know what'll happen? I'll direct the spaceships and stuff. You direct the actors. And I think he wanted him to help with the screenplay, too. And the guy told him no. Oh, man. And so Lucas ended up doing all of it himself, executive producing and writing and directing, and with Rick McCallum as his only guy to tell him no, who never told him no. Yeah, that's a great idea, George. Man. But the thing of it is, it's so easy to see that all you got to do is completely scrap episode one. You don't need episode one at all. You know, when I was 3, when I was 4, when I was 5, did I need Luke to be 9 to want to be Luke? Do I need Han Solo to be 10 to be interested in the adventures of Han Solo? Answer, no. So you just throw episode 1 completely in the garbage. You start the movie with episode 2, the beginning of the Clone War. And yeah, you can tell a little bit of backstory, how it is that Anakin has a little bit different background than the other Jedi Knights, you know? Then you do episode 2, you show the war. The Clone Wars. We're supposed to be happy with Clone Wars cartoons that come out later that tell the stories between 2 and 3 and hardly have any politics in them except the one where they're pushing the CIA's line on the Syria war. Did you see that? What a disgrace. Episode 2 should have been the Clone Wars, and then episode 3 could have been episode 3, only with better directing and better writing. Better actors. You know, I even read where, like, they had trained and practiced and they had 2 badass stunt doubles to play the Emperor and Sam Jackson. And they had it all set up. And then Lucas shows up at the last minute and goes, oh, no stunt doubles. This entire scene is to be shot in complete, total close-up. So somebody teach Ian McDiarmid how to lightsaber fight for 20 minutes and then y'all go ahead and film it. Oh, man. That's why that scene is like that? You see, if there'd been a different director, you know, with more or less the same story, but just doing it different. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. We talk about the police state, too. Our first guest today is Will Potter from Green is the New Red. And I know there's a double meaning there, but still. Here he is doing a TED Talk. At TED.com, in fact, it's his second one, I guess, at TED.com, Will Potter, the secret U.S. prisons you've never heard of before. Of course, the title was written assuming that people aren't listeners to this show, which is a fair assumption, I guess. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Doing good okay. To have you here, man. I sure appreciate your focus on this, especially still after all this time. And you have a lot more to say now than back before when you had a lot to say. Very interesting, very little covered, very important subject here. The communications management units or CMUs within two different U.S. prisons. I guess let's start with that. Where are they, these CMUs? And then what are they?
So the CMUs are prisons within prisons. They are experimental prison units that were open within two larger federal prisons. One is in Terre Haute, Indiana, and the other is in Marion, Illinois. And neither of them underwent any of the formal review process that's required by law. And now, they were opened under the Bush administration, but under the Obama administration, there's been a make these facilities permanent. And what they do is radically restrict prisoner communication with the outside world to levels that meet or exceed some of the most extreme prisons in the United States. But the reason I came across these units in my reporting and have been focusing so much on them is that they single people out because of their race or their political beliefs. Some of the environmentalists and animal rights activists and others that have been placed in these CMUs have been there because of their, quote, anti-government and anti-corporate views, according to counterterrorism unit documents. So, I think that just the simple existence of these units in within larger federal prisons raises a lot of human rights and civil rights concerns. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's also the question of the origin of that. I mean, did Congress ever say that that's a good enough reason to do this, or these are just rules and regulations adopted by the Bureau of Prisons?
Exactly. And it's the latter. And I think this is something we're seeing as a trend. I mean, you certainly talked a lot about on your show, both with foreign policy and domestic, of setting up kind of a parallel legal system for anything that involves the war on terrorism or this rhetoric of national security, a separate system that isn't subjected to the same oversight, the same, rules and procedures that other parts of the government have to go through. So in this case, they weren't run through Congress. They weren't subjected to the Administrative Procedures Act and, shuttled through all the processes that new prison units have to go through. And it took 9 years before the government finally issued something into the congressional record and starting to make these facilities permanent and codify what they are and how people get there.
Yeah, it's amazing that you know what? Here's the question. Do you have a single congressman or senator who's interested in this, who'd like to hold some hearings about it, who cares at all? Have you heard?
I haven't, but, to be fair, that's also not where I'm focusing my work. I mean, I'm not doing lobbying work or anything like that.
And, yeah.
Plugged into that kind of discussion in D.C., but there might be discussions of that going on. I'm not sure, but
if there was a reaction to your work.
I would know.
Right? Yeah.
I would hope I would know, but the short answer is no, I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just Congress, but there are 535 of them, so it's possible that one of them somewhere might think they could get some mileage out of this or something, you know? I don't know.
Well, and especially because I think there is a shift going on right now in how people are talking about a lot of the issues that are wrapped up in this story, talking about prisons, about surveillance, about national security and labeling people as terrorists. And I think there's all of those things are really wrapped up in this discussion of CMUs. And so I hope that discussion at the federal level and congressional level happens. Even just having a congressional hearing on this could shine substantially more light on what's actually taking place and get some better answers of how these prison units are operating, what they're really intended to be, and whether or not they're going to be expanded as well.
Mm. All right, now, I'm not sure if it's the line itself or maybe in the background. Do you have a fan on or air conditioner or something kind of high-pitched and loud there?
I don't. There's an overhead light that I can turn off to see if that's helped at all.
Sure. I think it might just be the phone line. It might just be my headphones. Anyway. So, listen, I think it's really important that you're doing a TED Talk, that you did a TED Talk about this. I'm kind of surprised and pleased that you found interest there. And, you know, I like to think that this will do a lot of good for the subject matter becoming, you know, more prominent and discussed by, let's say, anyone but you in this country.
Right.
You know, and
right.
Maybe make a little bit of progress here. So that's, you know, really good news in and of itself. Because, of course, there are all kinds of experts in all kinds of fields, most of which are not controversial at all, who will have access to this now, who will be able to see this and hopefully will take some interest in it. So, you know, at least that's good.
Absolutely. I mean, and certainly that's my goal and what's been guiding my work is, you know, slowly but surely trying to make inroads into that broader discussion. And I think it's incredible that TED is, you know, not only giving me a platform to do this several times now, but also, you know, putting it out on other social media and emails. And I mean, these are millions and millions of people. So I hope it gets that discussion going. I mean, like you said, this isn't a conversation that I think a lot of the typical TED Talk followers might be exposed to normally. So I think this is, you know, a huge progress in that regards.
Yeah. All right. Now, this is sort of a side issue because it's all state power anyway, but I'm curious, and the chat room's asking, whether these two prisons in Terre Haute, Indiana, and Marion, Illinois, where these CMUs are located, are they privately run prisons or run?
No,
or I guess
not.
They're run by the federal government itself, right?
They are. They're part of federal prisons. So the prison in Terre Haute and the prison in Marion. It's a good question, though, and that's one that's come up. I've been kind of surprised how much that's come up in online comments and emails and things I've gotten from people, because I think it shows there's a lot more awareness of private prisons and how they're growing.
Well, people can see, you just say the word private prison and everybody can see the perverse incentive in having, you know, lobbyists who have an interest, a private profit interest in criminalizing the existence of all the rest of their fellow citizens. You know, government run prisons are bad enough, but you mix that kind of profit motive with the thing and you could see the obvious, the huge conflict of interest between, you know, the people behind them and the rest of us who want to live in a free society there, you know?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's really inspiring to me to see how much that message is starting to get out to people and how much people are starting to understand it. Yeah, and frankly, even though it's a very different issue, I think there's a lot of overlap between that and the issues we're talking about with the CMUs, and a lot of overlap with this general change in the national discussion about prisons. Mm-hmm. You know, Obama, to his credit, was the first president to visit a federal prison. Now, these CMUs are still operating under his watch, of course, but I think there's some changes that are taking place in how we're thinking about prison.
Yeah, it is. It's the general concept of, you know, so-called criminal justice on the state, local, and federal levels and everything. The prisons, the police abuse, the NSA spying, all of it finally being brought up to question by the American people. Hang on, it's Will Potter from Green is the New Red and from TED.com. We'll be right back about the communications management units. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Will Potter about these communication management units, the CMUs. There are two of them in America at federal prisons, one in Terre Haute, Indiana, the other one in Marion, Illinois. The guards and the prisoners call them Little Guantanamo. And, yeah, let's go back to that, Will. If you could elaborate a little bit more about the differences and sames between, say, Ted Kaczynski locked in the Supermax there at Terre Haute versus the guys who were locked in the communications management units?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, when you hear about, you know, the description of CMUs and these secretive prisons and the rhetoric of the government, you want to imagine people like that being in there. But in my research, actually not the case at all. I mean, the people that have been there, for instance, Yassin Arif, who is an imam, he was asked to bear witness to a loan, which is a tradition in Islamic culture. Turned out the guy who asked him to bear witness to a loan was an FBI informant who was trying to enlist someone else in a fake attack, and Arif didn't know anything about it. But he was convicted of conspiracy to be part of a terrorism plot. And sent ultimately to the CMU. It's those types of cases that, you know, these people have been convicted of crimes. It's not like Guantanamo in that regard. They've had their day in the court, but their day in court has been questionable at best. Some of the other people I've talked about that are in these CMUs or have been in CMUs include an environmentalist named Daniel McGowan, an animal rights activist named Andy Stepanian. Neither have been charged with actually harming anyone or anything like that. They had no disciplinary violations when they were in prison. They had no communications violations when they were in prison. And according to documents from the counterterrorism unit, they were sent there because of their words, because of their so-called anti-government beliefs and anti-corporate views. And for that, they were singled out for harsher punishment and sent to a restrictive facility.
Yeah, now, so let's go back because, you know, this is another TED Talk that I was happy to see. They had Trevor Aronson up there to talk about these FBI entrapment jobs.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure that I understand you right, what you're saying about this guy. Is there was a plot by the FBI to entrap some idiot. And as
right.
part of that plot to entrap some idiot, they needed this imam to oversee someone's promise to pay back a loan. The guy that they brought in had no idea about any of the rest of this stuff. And yet he
right.
was convicted for being part of a criminal conspiracy, even though there were no actual terrorists at all, unless you count the FBI.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's it 100%.
And now, wait a minute.
No
so, wait a minute, though. Is it
yep.
possible that he actually was guilty as hell and he would have, could have, should have known, and he probably did know, but he was playing dumb and, you know, this kind of thing, something like that?
Screwed him. I don't see even the slightest evidence of that. This is a case that got a lot of attention, and there's been a lot of great reporting about it, and I think New York Magazine did a big cover story, and a lot of great reporters have covered the story, and I haven't seen any indication of that at all. Now, you know, I also want to be clear, when I'm talking about some of the prisoners who are there, there are lots of ins and outs of everyone's different cases that, at the end of the day, I mean, people make mistakes, and so I'm not here to, you know, defend any one prisoner or any one case or anything like that. some of them, though, I think are so clearly, you know, in my view, just a miscarriage of justice and an entrapment that I wanted to highlight those in my talk. And I think Arif's case right. is one of those.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's huge. That's so important. And because, you know, I think it's the same thing with all the torture, which you can throw this in, if you ask me, is it's always justified, at least in the back of our minds, with, yeah, but Khalid Sheikh Mohammed really deserves it, so screw him. But that's not who we're talking about here. We're talking about a bunch of nobodies. Right. Bunch of people who actually, even if they deserve prison, they don't deserve this. This is crazy what's going on here.
And that's really my challenge to people who watch this TED Talk that I gave, the people who are listening to this. You know, my challenge to you all is to try to step back and from your own preconceived ideas of who you think prisoners are, whether you think, you know, that because someone has been convicted of a crime, they just deserve everything that's thrown at them, and think about what this all means in a bigger picture sense, not just for the individual prisoners, which is really important, but what it means about our democracy, what it means about our own commitment to human rights to allow things like this to happen, and also what it means about our own safety and security. You know, all of this is framed in that rhetoric, but the people that are being thrown in CMUs aren't posing that kind of a national security threat. And if anything, I think their cases should make a lot of us outraged about how national security resources are being spent.
Yeah, I mean, and especially going back to the beginning here, where these are just Bureau of Prison rules. This isn't even an unconstitutional law that was passed. This is just some bureaucrats decided. You know, the national security state decided by itself. And, you know, that's the big deal here. And then, of course, again, just like with the rest of the terror war, all the blowback on people who, you know, really are in the wrong category anyway. You know, like you're saying, the Earth Liberation Front guys who maybe do some property damage but never killed anybody.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
And this is all really a continuation of that trend in my mind. I mean, as you know, most of my work has focused on those issues in particular, how nonviolent activists have been labeled as the number one domestic terrorism threat by the FBI. And I look at how the social movements have been affected since September 11th. But I think with this talk, what I hope to expose to people also is how institutionalized all of this has become. That it's not, you know, the fringe activities of a few random bureaucrats without oversight, or, you know, some misguided policy that got on the books that's going to be corrected. No, these are standard practices now. This is how this war on terrorism rhetoric has taken on a life of its own, to the point that these new units are opened, and no one really even knows how or why this all came about. I mean, that's been something that's been really difficult to answer, even as new court documents and open records documents come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also, you know, it's really something, maybe I'm being repetitive here, but it's kind of its own news story that it's left to you to do this. No offense, you're a great journalist. You do great work. I don't mean it like that, but I just mean, where the hell are all of our journalistic institutions on this question? They're completely AWOL.
And that's something that's unsettling to me on a lot of levels. One other one is that, you know, one thing I talk about in this talk is how in the course of my investigation and discussion of CMUs, I found more evidence about how my own work has been monitored by the counterterrorism unit and by the FBI in relation to speeches I've given about CMUs, media interviews like this one, articles I've written, things like that. And I think that's connected to the point you raised, because as more and more of our media has to shift to this kind of a freelance model or citizen journalist or whatever you want to call it, in addition to people like me that kind of came out of the mainstream media outlets and now work on my own, we don't have the institutional protections of someone at, you know, the Washington Post or New York Times. And that raises a lot of really troubling concerns, too. I mean, if major media outlets aren't devoting resources to investigative journalism anymore, or they're cutting it back, the people who are going out there and trying to do this don't have a lot of those same protections.
Right. All right. Now, so can you talk about when you went there and I guess they let you go not as a journalist, but just as a quote-unquote friend of this guy McGowan from the Earth Liberation Front. Anything notable there you want to tell people about?
Yeah, and they made very clear from the start that journalists are not allowed here. I've been reporting on McGowan's case since the first day of his arrest, and been following it throughout, through all the court processes, the trial, plea agreements, conviction. And so I was able to visit because of that relationship that I developed with him, but they don't allow reporters there. And in fact, when I was approved to visit, which I was really surprised about, McGowan was told by prison officials that if I wrote anything about the visit, that he would be punished for my reporting. That kind of a twist is really disturbing, and should be disturbing to everybody that's listening to this, because it's just to emphasize again, that's threatening prisoners with even harsher treatment if a completely separate entity, a separate journalist, writes about their case.
Which I guess we can assume has happened, right? Since your TED Talk, now you're doing this show again.
Well, so McGowan's been released. He's out of the CMU.
Oh, he's out
of prison. But he came under fire through his own, efforts to expose what happened as well. After he was released, he wrote an article that went up on the Huffington Post that was headlined, "Court Documents Prove I Was Sent to a CMU for My Political Speech." The very next day, he was thrown back in jail for his political speech. And his attorneys got his release very quickly, but I think the message was quite clear that, you're not allowed to talk about this place.
Now, is that actually part of the conditions of his release, or just in effect it is?
No, it was not. And that's what his attorneys with the Center for Constitutional Rights argued very quickly and forcefully, that the government was trying to enforce a
Was he still talking and writing since then, or they've advised him that he better go ahead and cool it?
He still is. He's active on, social media, and he's done some other articles since then about environmental issues in general. He's involved in environmental organizing in New York. But I mean, that's a very clear message, and that's just, that's a lot to put on people who are coming out of a very traumatic situation as well. That additional fear of just, if they speak out, could they be targeted further?
Yeah. Well, that's where we are, y'all. 2015 here. Oh, it's been like this for a little while. And yet, I guess I have to go back to the journalism thing. Well, I think that is the biggest part of this story, is that we have these communications management units and that you are virtually alone in reporting on them. There's a complete blackout where there ought to be a massive controversy right now about the way this is happening. So, I sure do. I don't know. I'm going to do my best to tweet it out some more and pass it around. I'll encourage all the listeners, go ahead and harass a journalist, with this link, man, and see what you can do to get them to report on this. This deserves to be a huge, and just think about if it was you or me, audience, locked in a prison. We're not even allowed to talk on the phone. We just got to hope that somebody out there is paying attention enough that they'll pick up the ball and run with it on their own accord, because we can't even encourage them to do it. Because that's how deep in the hole they got us locked. Imagine being in that position. And for sending medicine to, dying Iraqi children. Or for, being part of the entrapment of somebody else in some FBI sting. I don't know. I'm not very good with the call to action thing, Will, but I'm trying to, because I'm pissed off about this.
It seems like something ought to happen.
And I
appreciate everybody who's listening, if you could take the time to share that around as well, because that's been a challenge with this work too, is that, I'm approaching this as a journalist, but I mean, as you can tell from my talk, like, it's something I'm passionate about. There is an advocacy element because, I think that's been absent from the discussion. I think there needs to be a more forceful dialogue about these issues. That's not just, swallowing government sound bites about this stuff that have been completely misleading and deceptive. And so in doing that, I think it's important to be, to do journalism that's a bit more adversarial and try to get this message out there.
Right on. Well, great work as always. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Scott.
All right, y'all. sorry. That's Will Potter. He's at Green is the New Red. That's his website, greenisthenewred.com. And then here he is at TED.com. Will Potter, the secret U.S. prisons you've never heard of before. Great speech that he gave. So check out my Twitter feed, and you'll have the link to the speech, and help pass it around. Would you? Thanks. Be right back after this.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from mastersamuraitech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at mastersamuraitech.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And now, if this ain't the most interesting thing I've read in a while. The Disappearing Prince of Darkness by the great Jim Loeb. Jim, of course, is the Washington Bureau Chief of Interpress Service and runs the blog Loeblog.com, Loeblog.com. And, well, he is a world-renowned expert in the neoconservative movement and has written, oh, I don't know, hundreds probably of articles about the neocons as a separate and distinct species of Republican, basically, ever since the 1970s, and knows as much about them as is as expert on the neocons as anyone in the world, or better. So, welcome back, Jim. Good to talk to you again.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking I've been interviewing you for about 12, 13 years now, and I have learned probably more about the neoconservatives and what their movement is and isn't and who they are and who they're not and everything else from you, you know, as compared to any other source. And so I really highly urge people to check out your stuff. Okay,
well,
so
that's very kind. I hope people don't think I'm an obsessive.
No, you just you know what? I think if you took the American public in 2002 and 2003 and told them there's a special kind of Republican that you don't know about, and there's only about 50 of them, and they're the ones who are doing this, and here's who they are and what they're about. We would have all just been shocked. Nobody knew. Everybody just thought the Republicans were the Republicans. And yet, this subset, this neoconservative movement is hugely important. And none of them are less important, or at least in the last, decades, none of them, more important, I meant to say, than this guy, Richard Perle, the Prince of Darkness, who, you have noticed, just as I had noticed, hasn't been seen much in public lately, except for a couple of Newsmax interviews. But so tell the people, who is Richard Perle and why are we so interested in what he's doing nowadays anyway?
Or what he's not doing. I really don't know. I mean, I've talked with people who know him and who deal with him fairly regularly. And when I ask the question is, what is he doing? Have you seen him recently? They also he noted that he just hadn't been visible in recent weeks and months. Richard Perle is a neoconservative. He was hired by Scoop Jackson, my old senator, when I was growing up in Seattle. He was the senator from Boeing. He was hired, I believe, in 69 by Jackson and worked as his number two foreign affairs advisor. Hired a number of other people who would become very prominent neoconservatives in their own right, people like Elliot Abrams, like Frank Gaffney, Even Douglas Feith interned in the office in the 1970s. It became what I've referred to as a kind of hatchery for Washington neoconservatives. I mean, neoconservatives began less as a Washington movement, more as a New York intellectual movement, former Trotskyites who identified strongly with the Democratic Party, who were mainly interested in domestic issues initially, but then moved to kind of into foreign policy, and became prominent in the 1970s due to their opposition to détente, and then their support for, subsequent opposition to Jimmy Carter, under whom many of them switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And then they had a flowering in the first 4 years of the Reagan administration, and then they kind of lost some influence, particularly to George Shultz, who wasn't so neocon inclined, then spent the 90s kind of far from the executive office building or the State Department, to return under George W. Bush with renewed vigor. And he obviously, the first term in particular of Bush was dominated by neoconservative thinking after 9/11. In the middle of all this, Pearl was, I think, probably the most central neoconservative operative in Washington. That is, if you looked at all the various organizations that we consider to be neoconservative, the kind of one common person always seemed to have been Richard Pearl. And if you look at the first term of the Bush administration and you look at where neocons wielded the greatest influence, you can see that Richard Pearl's influence, which he exerted particularly over Donald Rumsfeld, who thought that Richard Pearl was the smartest man in the world, or at least among the smartest men in the world, besides perhaps Rumsfeld himself. And Dick Cheney was a partner of Pearl's dating back to the derailing of détente and so-called Team B back in the mid-1970s. He really has been just a critical person in the growth of the operational arm of the movement in Washington, D.C. And so his disappearance was really, or his apparent or relative disappearance over the summer into the fall has been quite surprising to me. And apparently, when they thought of it, even to some prominent neoconservatives who just noticed that he really hadn't played any kind of role, particularly in the Iran debate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now, so let's talk about that. There was a huge, let's go back to before that. I mean, it seemed to me like he kind of dropped out years ago, maybe right at the end of all the kind of fake half apologies for Iraq in 2009 or 2008 and 9 as Obama was coming in. But I don't think I've seen him anywhere except Newsmax since then, and with years going in between.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big mysteries that I haven't been able to clear up is what relationship, if any, he has with with the American Enterprise Institute, which was his perch since he left the Reagan administration in 1989. It seems he's just basically not there anymore. And I got conflicting accounts as to whether he has any affiliation. He apparently doesn't have an office there any longer. It's just extraordinary to me. Now, I did a Nexus search, which I didn't include in the piece I wrote on the blog, but he was actually quoted in between 2001 and 2006, he was, I think, appeared in over with respect to either Iraq or Iran. He appeared in like 1,200 articles on Nexus, and then between 2006 and 2011, he appeared in even more, like 1,600. So he didn't fade out in 2008 or 2009, but since 2011, like that number just dropped to like under 200. So I think he may have started kind of leaving at least the media scene, the mainstream media scene in particular, beginning around 2011.
Mm-hmm. Could it be, Jim, that it's because he's discredited, that his name is mud and nobody wants to be associated with him? Or is that too optimistic of a spin on it?
Well, I kind of noted that in the piece I wrote as one possibility, that the mainstream media now just considers him too far beyond the pale. And in fact, the fact that he still appears at through Gaffney's media. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gaffney has gone completely, I don't know, well, completely beyond the pale is understating it. I mean, he's an out-and-out Islamophobe. Although I still think he's supported in part by major defense industries because he's important to them. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he appears in that fever swamp of Frank Gaffney and virtually nowhere else is like amazing, and could be that the mainstream media decided that Pearl is just has discredited himself far too much.
All right, now hold it right there, Jim. We'll be right back, y'all, right after this.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom. The history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Jim Loeb from ipsnews.net and loeblog.com. Loeb like your earlobe. Loeblog.com. And we're talking about Richard Pearl, the formerly very, very most probably influential neoconservative ringleader, right up there with Paul Wolfowitz at the very highest levels of power, especially in the first Bush Jr. administration, and one of the kingpins at the American Enterprise Institute with Michael Ledeen and the rest of the worst of these guys. And now apparently he's on the outs. And has barely been heard from, except for he's palling around with Frank Gaffney, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, you're far more the expert than me on this. My impression always really was that Frank Gaffney was basically the scum of the neocon movement, and that the more upper crust ones didn't necessarily pal around with him that much. But then, I can't remember who it was, told me, that's not really right. They're all scum, just like Gaffney, and they're all perfectly happy to hang around with him all the time. Don't assume too much there. You seem to kind of make a class distinction among neocons, too. And I don't mean by how much money they make. They all work for Northrop Grumman at the end of the day. But I just mean in terms of, you know, like you said, where Gaffney's a lunatic out, you know, smearing all Muslims and acting crazy in a way that Paul Wolfowitz wouldn't do publicly, right?
Well, that's true, and I mean, especially when you make that comparison, because Wolfowitz, I mean, unlike many, many neoconservatives, is definitely not an Islamophobe. I mean, he's somebody who stated, you know, who got into trouble with other neoconservatives for actually expressing some degree of sympathy for Palestinians. That was when he was in the Bush administration. I mean, he's a very rare neocon in the sense that he actually has a degree of empathy, and he wants to understand Islam, and he's tried to spend some time in his life actually doing that when he was ambassador to Indonesia and so on. I mean, he's somebody who I actually think has more kind of liberal values than the vast majority of neoconservatives. I mean, Pearl has been Islamophobic in his own way, but he you know, when he does speak, he's pretty subtle in what he says, and he tends to be understated, and he Whereas, I mean, Gaffney is just makes his Islamophobic politics, you know, blatant and clear and repetitive and goes on and on about it. I just don't see Pearl as quite as, I mean, he's just not as public about whatever Islamophobia he has. He wrote a book in about 6 months after the invasion of Iraq with David Frum called An End to Evil. And if you read that, I mean, Islamophobia definitely plays a big role in that book. So does Iranophobia and Arabophobia and other kinds of phobias that you might, even Europophobia or Francophobia.
Yeah, they got them all. A lack of a national idea phobia.
Right. But he's, you know, he tends to be, you know, soft-spoken in his presentation. He's a very good debater. He's usually careful in what he actually says, things like that. I mean, he's a pretty subtle guy.
But he still can't get anybody to pay attention to him now, other than people like Gaffney,
Another consideration, aside from the fact that maybe the major media now think that he is discredited, is that he may have been somewhat displaced, especially during the Iranian debate, because you have John Bolton, who's really a right-wing hawk, not a classic neoconservative in the sense that he doesn't come out of the Democratic Party. He has right. No Trotskyite roots, and so on. But you've got Bolton at AEI constantly writing, constantly appearing on television and taking up a lot of oxygen. And an even more important figure who did take up enormous amounts of oxygen every time he chose – of media oxygen every time he chose to do so was, of course, Dick Cheney. And Cheney, again, comes from the right. He's not a true neoconservative, but most of his ideas are, indeed, you know, translate into neoconservatism. And his critique of Obama is totally neocon in orientation. And whenever he wanted to speak or appear on air, I mean, there he was. And he, you know, arguably, he's a much more prominent, famous draw than Richard Pearl, who tended more to be a behind-the-scenes actor, or tends more to be a behind-the-scenes actor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he was pretty prominent on TV, certainly in the run-up to the war.
Sure. Like, he and James Woolsey, whose only major claim to fame is that he served a year as CIA director, a year that Clinton, whose CIA director he was, I think, kind of regrets. He and Woolsey were probably the most active outside the administration in pushing toward war.
Mm. You know, by the way, speaking of Woolsey, have you heard before the anecdote that when Clinton met him that he said, oh my God, this guy's a nut, keep him away from me, and let's find a way to replace him as soon as we can, and that kind of thing?
I haven't heard that specific one. I did hear that Clinton had called him a blowhard at one time. And Woolsey, you know, Woolsey himself, I mean, he has a sense of humor. I mean, he said that, you know, he never really got into the White House. I mean, he never really got any time with Clinton, and that was probably good for Clinton because yeah. I think Woolsey's kind of a little bit not on the same planet.
Yeah, well,
many
I mean,
people inhabit.
Here's a guy who was the head of the CIA who believed all the Milroy theories about Al-Qaeda's just a front for Iraq's Mukhbarat and all that, right?
Well, I don't know whether he believed it or not.
Or claimed to, anyway.
Well, he certainly propagated that belief. But, yeah. I mean, he's a very strange guy. I mean, very strange in many of his ideas and the enthusiasm with which he pursues them.
But now, so Danielle Pletka that runs AEI now, you couldn't get a straight answer out of her that what is Pearl's role there now?
Well, no, I didn't talk with her. I talked with the press person and with the receptionist. I've been persona non grata at AEI since 2002 when I
Not until 2002? Wow. That's pretty great.
Yeah, because of a BBC documentary that AEI didn't like at all.
The War Party, yes.
And they blamed me for putting it together, and I don't think I had that. I don't think that was very fair to me. I simply was interviewed for the show. So I mean, they basically said you're not welcome here. And I sent an email to the media person. I said, what exactly is Richard Perle's status at AEI? And she never replied. So I consider that probably my status is more or less unchanged. Mm-hmm.
Well, she did can Ledeen, right? We know she canned Ledeen back a few years ago, right?
No, we don't know it for a fact.
Oh, no?
And it may be that Ledeen was lured away by more money at FTD. I mean, I frankly don't know. But he, too, is pretty – I mean, he's disappeared virtually – I mean, I think pretty altogether from mainstream outlets.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah,
I mean, does he even write for the National Review?
Gaffney. He's in the Gaffney world.
I think. He doesn't even write for National Review anymore, right? Ledeen?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't noticed anything by him, but I don't really read it as religiously as perhaps I did at one time.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, great interview. Thanks very much, Jim. Appreciate it. Great article, too.
Sure. Not at all.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I know, I just want to talk about Star Wars, but I guess I got to talk about other stuff. There was something else about Star Wars I was going to say. Oh, yeah. I don't know whether this stands the test of time, really. But I did a show 10 years ago. Right before episode 3 came out, this is just for you diehard Scott Horton Show and Star Wars fans. The rest of you won't care. But 10 years ago, I did a show right before episode 3 came out where I played some clips and this and that, and I talked about the rise of the evil galactic, the evil galactic empire. And the engineering of big, fake, phony wars in order to accomplish it. And the historical metaphors and parallels and that kind of crap. And some people liked it. And I haven't heard it for a long, long time. So I don't know whether I should really be embarrassed by it or think that, yeah, it's pretty good. But anyway, it's me on the politics of Star Wars. And all you got to do is just go back to, May 2005 in the archives at scotthorton.org. And you'll be able to find it. So if you really like Star Wars and you want to hear me talk about Star Wars and the American Empire. Oh, actually, I wrote an article like that, too. And actually, the article's no good. You should actually read Anthony Gregory's article that he wrote about Star Wars and the American Empire. It's way better than mine. But I did write one. It's called Star Wars and the American Empire. And then also, there's an interview of Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute about it. And then there's the hour-long thing of me. Talking about not quite an hour long. So that's all at scotthorton.org. If you like Star Wars and you like hearing me say stuff. All right. I thought this was cool, man. You know, the wife, she hasn't really done any reporting in about 5 years, but this guy was saying, I was bad mouthing Raw Story. I said, Raw Story, no good without Larissa. And he says, whatever happened to her? What a great reporter she was and a great writer. And I says, oh, she married me. And he says, wow, really? She married you? In all capital letters. No way. Lucky guy. So that was cool, man. I like that. It's true that people who are familiar with her journalism really appreciated it. Well, pretty much all of them, I'd guess, anyway. All right. By the way, Jim Loeb just mentioned a documentary that he's in. From 2003, it's called The War Party. As he said, it's a BBC documentary, and I just put the link in the chat room, although if you join up the chat room now, it'll be too late to see it, although I guess you could ask the guys. Also, you could just drop by my Twitter feed, at Scott Horton Show, and find the link there. Or just Google BBC War Party, and it'll come right up. And I haven't watched it in a long time, but I think it's pretty damn good. If I remember correctly, I would recommend that you watch it if you want to know about how they lodged into war back in 03, 02 and 03. Yeah, anyway. All right. Now, I guess here's a little bit of housekeeping for the show today that I should have done before, but I was talking about Star Wars. And that is that I'm writing the book with Tom Woods. It's back on. Many of you have asked. That's funny. I just said nay. Many of you have asked, hey man, whatever happened to you and Tom Woods? Are going to write a book. Well, it's going to happen now. I talked with him and it's basically in motion. I basically can't do it until I get some kind of advance. Because I just can't. Because I just got too much other stuff. So we're going to have to work out a deal with somebody and then write the book. Now, here's the good news. The book is basically already written. The book is what I tell you every day. Just all of it, all in one place, written down. That's all. Everything that happened according to me. That's what the book is. And the war on terrorism. Why two? And so that's what the book will be. I'm going to write it. As I write it, I'm going to send it off to Tom to make better. By the end, I hope we're still friends. I'm sure it'll be fine. And then, yeah, man, I don't know how long it'll take. What is it now? October? I don't know when it'll be out. I don't know how long it'll take me to write. It shouldn't take me that long to write, really, man. All I gotta do is just puke it up. I got the outline done. I just have to be able to take the time to fill it in. And I think I can do that. And I should have been writing books all along, but I never knew what to pare it down to. Which is kind of stupid. I had a couple of false starts. I was going to write two different books with Phil Giraldi. The first one was going to be about all the bogus terrorism prosecutions, which all the publishers told us go to hell, so we didn't do it. And then they ended up publishing the great Trevor Aronson and his book about it, The Terror Factory. So go figure that. Although I don't think we asked whoever his publisher turned out to be. Anyway, and then we were going to write another one that was basically going to be the case against the case for war with Iran. The case against the Israel lobby's point of view on Iran. And they also told us, nah, we got 100 Iran books. And unless you're really breaking, you know, brand new secrets in here, former CIA man, we don't want to do it. That's what they told us, so we didn't do it. It was going to be good, too. Man, the sample chapter that Phil had written up, tell you what, I think we ended up publishing it somewhere anyway, but. But so now, yeah, I'm going to do it, man. And, my co-author will be New York Times best-selling author, Tom Woods. And so that's going to help get it some notice, I hope. We'll see how that goes. So that's going to happen. Unless it doesn't. But looking like it will. It is looking like it will. All right, here's another little bit of news. I won't say the exact number, because it's not actually accurate anyway, give or take a couple. It's pretty close, though. And I'm not sure if I'll be able to get it finished by the end of next week or not. But we are conceivably within a week or so of having done 4,000 interviews on this show, which is a lot. I think I might get drunk. I think I should have Gareth on to be my, or maybe Ron. You know, Ron Paul was my first interview once I started The Daily Show. Ron Paul and Bob Dreyfus about the wars at the very end of 2006. I mean, I had a show before that, different shows before that, but they were weekly. And anyway. Dead air for you guys? What the hell? Oh, man. That sucks. Well, LRN kicked me off the air. Wouldn't you know it? Here, let's see if we can fix it. All right. Did that fix it? You know, this thing ought to beep at me or something when it hangs up on me. All right, chat room guys. Can you hear me now? Am I even on or something else kicked on? You got to let me know. We're back. You can hear me? Okay, good. All right. Well, I don't know what happened. How long was I off? On and on and on I was talking. Things I was saying. How long was I gone, y'all? Tell me. How long will it take you to hear me just ask you that? A little while, I guess. 5 minutes? Did you even hear the news? 5 minutes I was off, they say. Great. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all, welcome back. Man, that sucks that LRN hung up on me, but I didn't know it. So I lost my connection for a few minutes there. Yeah, well, anyway, whatever, dude. All I was saying was, I'm going to write a book with Tom Woods. I'm not going to go back over it all. We were going to write a book, and then it got put off, but now we're getting to work on maybe doing it. Okay, there, that's it. All right. Now, look, here's things I didn't get a chance to say, but you have to know that the U.S. is admitting that, yeah, they knew it was a hospital they were attacking in Afghanistan. They were lying before when they said it was an accident. Now they're saying they believed incorrectly there was a Pakistani spy inside the hospital. Isn't that what I told you? Hell yeah, they bomb a hospital over an assassination of one high-value target. Of course they would. Think they wouldn't? That's the most likely explanation, isn't it? And then here, they admit it. Oh, but you know what? Their flag is red, white, and blue, and they're from the middle part of North America, and so it's not a war crime if they bomb a hospital. Yeah, because, you know, they might nominally, possibly claim to believe in Jesus. And not only that, they're government employees. And not only that, the people that they're murdering were foreigners. And so, it's fine. They have a license to slaughter any person in any hospital bed anywhere in the world. Because, you know, the middle part of North America is magic. And if you're born from the middle part of North America, then that means you're really special. No wonder you feel so good about yourself all the time. You're a very special person. If you get a job working for the government, you can burn little children, wounded children. You can burn them to death in their hospital beds, and you get a medal. You get a medal. They're bragging about it now. Well, we think there was a Pakistani spy in there. That's their excuse. They're no longer lying that, well, we didn't know it was a hospital because of communication breakdown. Yeah, we knew it was a hospital. Yeah, we fired incendiary rounds at them and burned them to death in their hospital beds. Slaughtered surgeons. But hey, we had intelligence that made us feel like we wanted to. Get it? So that's it. You can go ahead and give up your investigation now. Americans can murder whoever they... Oh, American government employees can murder whoever they feel like any time of the day, no matter what. From your little sister to somebody else's over there burning to death in a Kunduz hospital bed. They have sovereign immunity, which means they own you. They are the masters. We are the slaves. They have total power, and we have no rights at all unless we go work for them. As a Williamson County deputy sheriff once put it, apocryphal. Well, looks to me like things around here are getting more and more Gestapo, and I just want to make sure I'm wearing a brown shirt. Get that? America, the Nazis. Oh, I know, but their flag was red and white and black, like the bad guys in the new Star Wars movie. And our flag is a different color. And they're from the middle part of Europe, and we're from the middle part of North America, so that's different. The war crimes, yeah, they're the same. The numbers of rotting, stinking corpses in the ground, yeah, that's pretty much right around accurate, yeah. But we're exceptional. That's the law. It says it right there in the Constitution. American government employees can murder whoever they want. Oh, and then they can drive a tank into the hospital to destroy all the evidence whenever they feel like it too. Oh, we're just here to investigate, they say as they drive the tank through the evidence. Like we haven't seen that before. You ever watch Waco? The Rules of Engagement, Waco, A New Revelation. I think especially in both of them. There are pictures of, hell, you could probably just Google it. And there are pictures of the cops standing around with bottles and bottles and bottles of bleach that they use to just pour all over their crime scene. It was a crime scene because they drove tanks through it. Anyway, they kept driving their tanks through it. Also, in Yemen, 500,000 Yemeni children are facing severe malnutrition, according to the UN. As we know, they import super majorities of their food. They've been under permanent blockade for more than half a year now. An American blockade. Obama's blockade. A Saudi blockade that America could call off with the raise of an eyebrow. And yet, as Gareth Porter reports, Obama doesn't want to end it. He's happy for the war on Yemen. He doesn't care how many children starve to death, just like all the children he starved to death in Somalia, 600,000 of them, according to his own government. According to a U.S. government-funded NGO, FuseNet, the Famine Early Warning System, Obama likes starving little babies to death. He's an American. He's exceptional. He's not really from the middle part of North America. He's from an American conquered former island kingdom out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but close enough for imperial work. And so he's exceptional. He can murder whoever he wants, including a bunch of Yemeni babies. In fact, he can murder them. He can murder them so much that it's not even newsworthy. If you're talking about ABC, CNN, NBC, CBS, the Lehrer News Hour, NPR News, any of the official American organs of opinion, I mean, Reuters is a British news service, but are American newspapers even reprinting this? That Obama and his Saudi allies are starving at least 500,000 Yemeni children to death? Is that even news? Well, you know, it's a proxy war, and there's a bunch of proxy wars, and did you hear about Jeb's latest foibles? Yeah. All right. And then, Palestine. Video. Israeli mob attacks Eritrean, mistaking him for Bedouin assailant. Well, they all look alike to me. The Jewish KKK members yelled as they lynched this guy? Huh, that's strange. Hey, Ku Klux Klan, did they know they had a branch of you in Israel? Yeah. White power, they all shouted. Well, they're virtually all Europeans. It's not like they're from the region. White power, they shouted. As they, oops, lynched the wrong guy. You know, if they'd lynched the right guy, well, that would have been one thing. Right, everybody? But the security guard shot him. And then everybody else, just like a bunch of cops, assumed, well, he must have shot him for a good reason. He must be the guy I want to help stomp to death. And so they did. One is where they threw a bench at him, while others kicked him as he bled out and died. For what? Because he was a bystander. Palestinian picked up a rifle and shot some IDF. This guy was crawling away. And they lynched him. The Israeli mob lynched him. Well, he was Eritrean. So, you know, black. So, in other words, he was the other in Israel, which must maintain its 80-20 super-duper white European Jewish super majority. Israel is for the white man. That's a direct quote of one of Benjamin Netanyahu's ministers. You know, like Israel's run by Woodrow Wilson or some Nazi like that. Some white supremacist movement like the Wilsonian Democrats. MondoWeiss.net for that story.